Working Cows Podcast, episode 169.
Welcome to the podcast that gives producers a platform to discuss and share paradigm-challenging practices. Practices that have increased the effectiveness of their operation and the joy that their families have received from this lifestyle.
Howdy, everybody. It's Clay Connery, host of the Working Cows Podcast, powered by the Global Ag Network, here with another episode for you guys.
Do you want to let you know about something coming up? South Dakota Soil Health Coalition annual conference is coming up January 6th and 7th. There will be links in the show notes page for today to their website and a flyer up there as well, but just a little preview of what they've got going on at the South Dakota Soil Health Coalition annual convention. Jimmy Emmons will be there. He is a guy doing cows and crops and rangeland management on a pretty good size scale in Dewey County, Oklahoma. Lauren Steinlogge is a soil health guy, no-till, multi-species cover crops, interseeding of cover crops, relay cropping for the last 10 or 15 years. He'll be there sharing his thoughts. Dale Strickler grew up on a diversified farm near Colony, Kansas, and then attended Kansas State University. He has been doing agronomy for 15 years before entering private industry. He's been an agronomist with Land O'Lakes, Starseed, Valent USA, and he's now an agronomist with Green Cover Seed based out of Bladen, Nebraska. So he'll be there as well as Nick Jorgensen. We've had the Jorgensen family on the podcast before, talking to them about what they're doing from a soil health perspective, what they're doing from a grazing cover crops perspective to develop the bulls that they're developing there. So they're managing 13,000 acres, and they save $100 per acre and $350 per head annually through their good soil health management. So looks like a good opportunity.
Really excited to be joined today by David Neeson. David is a horse trainer and day working cowboy in Texas. He's also the one behind the Everyday Horseman community. So be sure to check out the show notes page for today, workingcows.net/169 for show notes with links to everything that David's got going on. David was my guest for episode 113. And we closed out by talking a little bit about David and his work with dogs. And so when someone sent me a request to do some episodes talking about working ranch dogs, I knew that David was the one I wanted to reach out to and talk to him as well. So I'm really excited to talk to him today about some of what he's learned in his time working with dogs and cows and horses and those things. So, David, thanks for joining me today on the Working Cows Podcast.
Pleasure to be here.
Well, I've had requests a couple of different times for somebody to come on and talk about stock dogs. And I am not one who's familiar with their uses. We've had dogs that had the instinct around. I've been around dogs that had the instinct around, and since cancel culture and PETA don't seem to have a statute of limitations, I will not say publicly who those individuals were, but those dogs that had the instinct but not the person to work with them weren't always treated the nicest. So it's one of those things. You've got to find the right person and the right dog, and I think both kind of, I don't know how much, if it's equal training or more training for the person or more training for the dog to get things done right with dogs. But I've seen them work well, but I just haven't been around them that much. So I'd like to hear a little bit from you about what you kind of think of as the ideal scenario where dogs really shine. Is it in the pasture? Is it in the alleyway? Is it where is it that you really think of dogs being the most useful? And then we'll work through some other scenarios and chase some rabbits here and there.
So don't throw rocks at me too quick, but I think the ideal situation for a dog is anytime you're handling cattle. As vague as that is, I can, when you're in the pens, there's a place for them. When you're in the pasture gathering, there's a place for them. When you're in the woods hunting them, there's a place for them. The only time there's not a place for them is when town dogs show up. I've literally been gathering places next door to, like a neighborhood or something, and all of a sudden stray dogs show up and they're either wanting to fight my dogs, or maybe they're of a blue heeler cow dog mix of something. So there's some sort of instinct there, but they don't know what they're doing and they just get in the middle and cause problems. My dogs tend to cue off of seeing movement, and they see another dog and they think something's happening. They'll run to it, even though they don't realize it's a town dog that doesn't know anything. Handling yearlings, I love having a set of dogs. Really, I guess that's the ideal situation for having dogs is a guy that works by himself a lot. Mm. That is the ideal. If you're handling yearlings, cow-calf pairs, if you're in a pen, a feedlot situation, my dogs, that probably requires a little background discussion of the style and the types of the different breeds and how they prefer to work. But my dogs want to work to me. They push cattle to me. Mm. And that description is called balance in the industry. That dog has a lot of balance. And basically what it means is, like, if you're looking at the face of a clock and I was standing at 6 o'clock, the cattle are the hands, you know, the middle of the clock, my dogs want to be at 12. Mm. And without saying anything, without giving a command or training or anything, left to their own devices, if I move around to 9 o'clock, those dogs will kick around to 3 o'clock. Mm. They just want to be 180 degrees opposite, but they're always pushing. And kind of some of their training that's required is to back them off and not always be pushing. Like if I just need to hold a set of cows up or something. And so like in a feed yard situation, or, you know, where you're needing to sort something out, a lot of times, and I do this in my horse training, a lot of times, I'll have the cattle in a pen and I want a certain cow out to be able to train a colt on. And, or if you had a sick one or something, and I'll have the dog start pushing cattle up to the gate. Now there are better trainers than me. I don't claim to be a dog trainer. I'm just a dog user, but those guys have a lot better handle and can be really technical. The way I do it is I have them push cattle to me, and then I sit in the gate and use my horse to sort and kind of knock the cattle back that I don't want until the dogs have the one I do want, and then have them drive it to me. In a yearling situation, and this will get into more style as well, but a really strong-eyed technical dog that can kind of slink around can really help settle a set of yearlings, because they get really curious. Now, you got to have a brave dog, because those yearlings will all get curious and they want to come. They'll all gang up sniffing on him. And sometimes you just have to give that dog time to lay there and bite every one of them on the nose until they realize they can't all come put their nose on him and run over the top of him. And then you get into people's preferences and how they like to work or prefer, or what they don't care for. And I have worked for guys that don't want you to unload a dog out of your truck. You know, they cuss a dog because the last guy that came to there, you know, it's always that last guy and what he did. And so you've got dog with personalities, you've got people with personalities, owners, caretakers, people you're working for, your own personality, your own instincts. And man, it's just a lot of, personalities and beliefs that all kind of have to be managed. And so I don't consider myself a dog trainer. You know, I said I'm a dog user, but really I'm more of a dog observer and what my dogs do and what their tendencies and what their styles are. And then I just try to work toward what that dog is strongest at. In the woods with a set of cow-calf pairs, you know, that's where a cur dog that wants to bay and bark, there's just something instinctive about that barking that triggers cattle, even cattle that have never really been truly dog broke. They will just start coming to each other. They will find each other as a herd and kind of wad up. They want to keep those cows in the middle. You know, I guess it goes back to wolves and coyotes and things like that, that they just instinctively put those babies in the middle and then they kind of turn and face out and fight, but they're not so trotty. There's always an exception for everything. You'll get some cows that are sure enough wild. Brush cows are going to run, take their baby with them, maybe leave their baby even. But for the most part, those cattle will wad up. And then you can kind of confine them in some really dense woods. And so that's kind of, you know, most of the scenarios that I could think of, you know, in a pen, out of a pen, in a pasture with long, wide range of sight, like with yearlings on wheat. Or up in the hardwoods where you can't hardly see 20 feet in front of you.
Yeah, let's talk, circle back around to a couple of things you mentioned there. First of all, talk about that difference between instinct and training and skill. I don't know if those are the right words, but like a dog that's just got the instincts, that wants to do the work but doesn't know where he or she needs to be, when she needs to be there, any of those things. Is that kind of a night and day difference? Is there, or can you turn that instinct into skill in most dogs, or how do you think about those things?
Yeah. So, and that's where I get back to, I'm not a dog trainer. The dog has to have the desire. You couldn't bring me a Labrador retriever. And even though he'll fetch that ball and bring that ball back to me, that does not mean he's going to bring that. He has the tenacity, the drive, the grit to go bring a cow back to me that's running off just because. So the desire has to be there. Skill can be developed, but desire is the most critical. You know, the puppies, I tell people this all the time when I sell puppies. At 3 months of age, you need to start putting these suckers up. I mean, put them in a kennel, put them in a stock trailer. Do not let them run loose because they want to go to stock. At 3 months old, the instinct is already there, but they don't have the motor skills to be able to save their own life. If a mama cow, if they duck under a fence and get after a mama cow and she's got a baby calf, that mama cow will kill a 3-month-old puppy right now because that puppy can't even move and duck and dodge and get out of the way fast enough. So the skill can be developed, but the instinct and the desire has to be there. That comes to the next problem, which is people. They right. buy a puppy that has all that instinct bred in them that want to, and then it does something like chases their barn cat, and they start yelling and screaming, no, no, quit, stop, get out. And what they don't understand is that puppy doesn't know that that's a cat or that it's your favorite cat, and he doesn't care. He just saw movement, and he triggered on the movement. And so if you're going to yell and scream at him about chasing the cat, you're actually telling him it's not okay to work. And in his mind, he doesn't see the difference. He's either going to go after something that moves or he can't. He's not allowed to. And so what will happen is one of two things. If it's a little weaker, more timid dog, you're going to shut him down and he's going to give up and quit. If he's a strong, hard-headed dog, which usually make the better dogs, they just take a lot more work, you're going to make him sneaky. He's going to be that dog that sneaks out there and gets in the cattle, maybe gets into your neighbor's cattle, whatever, has stuff wadded up, and you can't catch him and you can't call him off because you've always been yelling, no, 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 stop. Or maybe you went somewhere and you know, today's the day I'm going to actually use this dog. I'm going to try. And you put him in there and he just goes berserk and he's got cattle wadded up in a corner. He maybe pushes something through a fence and you're like, that's it. I'm never using this dog again. Well, you know, he doesn't even know what he's doing. He's just doing instinct. He's just pushing. And so you have to set it up in a situation where you can control it. But if you give up real quick and you go, no, no, I'm never doing this again. You take that dog home and then you yell at him every time he looks at a cow because you just know he's fixing a chaser through a fence and you're not going to be able to stop him. That's the dog you'll make sneaky. And then he will be a pain and a problem the rest of his life. Mm. And you'll have to keep him put up and it won't be fun for him or you, or you always have to keep an eye on him or not trust him. But the best thing you can do for a stock dog that wants to work is let it work. You just need to set it up in an environment where you can control it. You know, a good stout set of pins, dog broke stock, go to a trainer, let somebody that knows what they're doing guide you for the first few times. And then they're going to have to mess up just like kids and colts and things like that. They're going to mess up as they learn. And you got to allow that. So you can definitely create the skill and they can get better as they go. But if they don't have that, I say this all the time too. If you got a dog that doesn't have the desire to go get in trouble, you probably don't have much dog. If he's real biddable and every time you clear your throat, he just hits the deck. He probably won't ever make a very good dog.
Kind of expand on that, go get in trouble idea. is that just a dog that's got kind of is brave and willing to take risks, or is that literally like this dog is gonna get in trouble?
Yeah, it kind of both. Brave, obviously willing to take risks, maybe even try to duck away from you to keep working, you know, outrun you when you try to reach and grab him. But you know, if you turn your back on him for 10 minutes and you look up and he's gone, where is he? Is he out there chasing your horses? Is he, maybe you've got some chickens running loose and he's got them wadded up. He might even kill a chicken. And I've literally had this discussion with people that bought a dog from me. And we can go into that later because our PETA audience isn't going to talk about chicken killing dogs. that they cue off of movement. When they see movement, especially in livestock, they are just drawn to it. And it entices them to go get around and what most people who don't know what they're looking at would call chase. My dogs don't chase my barn cat. they are trying to get ahead of him and stop him. And if he will stop, which my barn cats are pretty smart because there's five little black and white rascals all the time prowling around, they just know not to run. And those dogs, literally, he'll have five dogs staring at him if he doesn't move. If he moves, it's shame on him because they're going to go after him, but they're trying to stop his movement. That's what, I won't say that's what every breed of dog, but the border collie, the herding type dogs, they don't like chaos and movement. They want to contain that chaos. And so if it's still, that's what makes them happiest. Same thing with a cur dog, really. That's if a cow is running off, a cur dog is going to be running through the forest trying to get in front of her stopper. A true bay dog usually doesn't start baying until the cows go to wadding up, and then they start circling, or the cur dog guys call it windmilling, but they just run circles round and round, and that's when they start their bay. But when they're chasing a cow, they're not baying. They're trying to get ahead of him and stop him. There's exceptions to everything. You know, there's catch dogs built in within the cur dog breeds that will actually grab a hold of a cow and stop her. I have really gritty dogs that want to grab a hold and bite. And so if given the opportunity, they're going to reach in, especially if something won't stop running off. And that's where chickens are not going to be still. And so if a dog gets in, especially a puppy that doesn't know any better, gets into your chickens, and those chickens go to cackling and squawking and beating the air with their wings and stuff, and you got feathers flying, I mean, a dog can't help himself. If he's got any salt at all, he's going to grab one. It's just in him. Does it mean that if he's a chicken killer, he'll always be a chicken killer and you can't trust him? I don't think so. I think you just have to set it up. If that dog's kennel is sitting where all he can see all day are chickens pecking the ground and sorting through the stuff that's underneath the dog kennel, yeah, he's going to fixate on chickens and you're going to have to do something about that. But if you set it up where the chickens are somewhere else and the kennel is somewhere else and they don't see chickens, my dogs don't even know what a chicken is. they would never cue on one. I've actually tried to use them like on goats before, and because they've never seen a goat, my dogs are kind of, they just look at me like, what? Where's the cow? So as they get some age on them and they kind of know what their job is and what their responsibility is, they get pretty picky. Now, if you want them to work goats, put them on goats and show them what that looks like. You know, if you want them to work sheep or cows or, you know, whatever stock you're needing to herd, ducks, you know, just you put them on there, you teach them it's okay, knowing that they're going to get in trouble. You just have to set it up in a way that you can get them out of there. But if the going and getting in trouble literally looks like anything you can imagine. Now, I don't like one that wants to chase cars, but cars move. So that's a reality, you know, that they're going to cue on a moving car until you teach them not to.
In your previous episode on the Working Cows podcast, episode 113, we talked about horses and we talked a little bit about horse personalities and that each horse kind of has its own personality. I suppose each individual breed has, it's kind of, this is what they like to do, but each individual dog within that breed has its own personality. Is that right?
Yes. Yeah, most definitely. Breed is definitely going to affect that a lot. But across breeds, I'm going to say this with a fairly strong amount of confidence. Across breeds, I would say that there are four main characteristics or types, I guess you'd say, of dogs. And you can have multiple combinations of those types. And so I'll start going through them and help keep me straight here if I get sidetracked. But first, you have a strong-eyed dog. That's typically what you see in a border collie that's creeping, crouching, and staring. Then you have a loose-eyed dog. That is a dog that isn't focused on one particular spot or one particular animal. They tend to have a lot of action. They move a lot back and forth all the way around. Your cur dogs are going to be loose-eyed dogs, especially when they're windmilling and circling the entire herd. They see everything. And then you're going to have a loose dog, and that reference is in reference to where his proximity to the cattle. He doesn't want to work in close. He wants to work out loose, out away from the herd. And then the fourth one is a little controversial, and I don't mean it to be. It's just the guy that taught me, it was his terminology, and I just keep using it, and that is gritty. And I don't mean to insult somebody's dog that says, oh, that dog's not gritty. What I'm saying is a gritty dog, the way I'm talking about it, is a dog that wants to work in really tight and really close to the cattle and is more prone to grip and bite and fight a cow. And then you can have combinations of those. Right. You can have a strong-eyed loose dog, a strong-eyed gritty dog. You can have a loose-eyed loose dog or a loose-eyed gritty dog. And in my pack of five, I have all those combinations. And it's a good thing. Now, some guys don't understand that. They kind of think they have this ideal dog in their mind, and that's the only kind of dog they want. Well, my dogs can complement each other, because where one dog is strong and but has a weakness in another area, I can throw in a different style of dog that's strong in that area, and then they complement each other. Like I have one dog that is a loose-eyed, means she moves all the time, gritty dog. She is terrible on yearlings, because yearlings want to stampede and run off, right? They're looking for a reason to just tear out running, and she moves too much and it makes them nervous. And then she's going to be prone to work in too close to them, and all that movement's putting pressure on them. So they want to travel and get away from that pressure. And it just starts the momentum of that herd wanting to run off, especially if she hits one. And then I have a strong-eyed, gritty dog. So he wants to stare and work in close. He's terrible on pairs because he'll be trying to stare at one mama cow that's kind of wanting to back him down and bluff him a little bit. Well, you know, when they go to balling and he reaches up and bites her and she hollers, five other cows come, especially old South Texas brush cows that want to fight. He just drew the attention of five or six other cows, and now he's got to whip five or six old mama cows that are trying to fight him. And so he, a loose eyed dog in that situation where he will move, is a better dog because it's not a standing target. Now there's probably guys out there that'll argue with me there. Good Lord. There's lots of Facebook experts out there and some of the stock dog communities that I'm involved with that always want to preach. And they'll say things like, a man don't need but one good dog. Of course, I'm imagining how they sound in my, imagination. Grumpy old sir, man don't need but one good dog. If he got one, that's all he needs. They're like, well, sir, you've obviously never taken care of 1,000 to 1,200 head of yearlings, because you're going to kill one dog trying to handle 1,200 head of yearlings. The yearlings can't even see one dog. So when I'm in those scenarios, you know, I'm definitely taking more of a pack. I'm taking four or five dogs so that they can kick out wide and kind of the cattle can see them in all different directions and presences. So that those, I believe that those type of dogs exist, whether you're talking about a border collie, a Kelpie, an Australian Shepherd, or a cur dog type. And probably even within, if you threw in the blue heeler in there, that same would be true.
Do you have to then police those personalities by the situation and say, okay, this situation calls for this kind of dog. Everybody else you lay over there, this young man's going to go take care of this situation.
Most definitely. Most definitely. Usually what I try to do, because my dogs have such a high drive, is I try not to take the dog that doesn't fit. I just leave them home for the day. Now there are situations where I know I'm going to be outnumbered and I need all of them. And so maybe I keep that dog under my stirrup, you know, keep her closer to me and keep her out of the fight or out of the situation. Driving a set of pairs, handling pairs that have a, you know, 400 or 500 pound calf on them is one thing. Driving a set of pairs that have 2 or 3 month old calves on them is a whole nother deal. It's I'm talking cows that are dog broke gentle when they're dry. They want to come out and fight everything when those babies are just a month or two old. And they should, you know, I'm talking old South Texas brush cows that there's a lot of predators out there stalking around that they've got to constantly be on alert for. So, and they've got horns and they're looking for trouble. So usually I try not to even use my dogs on those days. And I tell guys that, and they're kind of like, what? And then the reason is my dogs are gritty dogs. I don't have any true loose dogs. I have loose eyed and I have strong eyed, but they're all gritty. They all want to work in close and fight. And so you know, dogs don't sweat. And I'm kind of here in the central Texas area and get pretty hot. And these dogs are carrying a little bit of hair with the Australian blood in them and the border collie blood. So they get hot pretty fast, and you can literally just fighting 10 to 15 mama cows. I can be out a dog in 20 minutes. And those dogs have got to go get wet. And in the time it takes them to go get wet so they can drop their body temperature down and get back in the fight, I could be losing the herd, you know? So it's best on those days to where I either leave them way back behind my horse so that they're there in an emergency, or we just hire extra cowboys for the day and we don't take them. You know, when those same cows are dry or the calves are bigger, it's not that big a deal. It's certain times of the year when those calves are real small.
And is a lot of that to do, as far as the personality of those dogs, is a lot of that to do with the bloodlines that you've been selecting for over time? These are gritty dogs because they came from gritty parents. Is that kind of how that works? Or
yeah, definitely. Definitely. There are, and you know, ironically, it was a cur dog guy that taught me that terminology. Before I got into dogs, I had dogs, but they were still pups, and I was still kind of unsure what I was doing. And I was taking care of a set of really nasty cattle on the down on the Brazos River, really grown up hardwoods. Just these cows had been getting away for years. And I finally talked the owner into letting me hire a guy that had a set of cur dogs. And I was so excited because he gave me permission to go in there and whip those dogs. And we were going to do this over about a six trip period. And in my mind, I thought this guy was going to roll in with a trailer load of like 30 cur dogs and just turn them loose. And I was going to get to watch them eat the faces off of these old spoiled nags. So I was tired of chasing them through the woods and only getting about half my gather every time. And he showed up with one old female that was pretty gritty and three, no kidding, 7-month-old pups. And those pups didn't have a lick of fight in them, but they had noses already and they already had the instinct. And I thought, what? Dude, I'm paying you. What in the world? He's like, just trust me. That was the coolest education I got. That guy took those three pups that did not want to fight at all. And he would sit, we would ride around. Those cattle used to exist in groups of threes and fours. No kidding. And this ranch was so overgrazed, grown up in brush. It was in terrible shape. It had honey locust all over it. I don't know if that translates to where you live or not, but honey locust kind of makes mesquite and weesach look silly. It looks like the stuff that they put on Jesus's head for his crown of thorns. I think it is the same bush, but it's really wide at the base, like a concrete nail, very pointed, and it's got a poison in it. And anyway, this place is covered in that stuff. We started riding and prowling. We found the first set of like four cows, and we stayed back. He's like, don't let those cows see you. And he hissed those dogs in there, and those puppies went in there, and they didn't want to fight. They just started barking and circling, and they stayed probably 30, 40 feet off those cows the whole time. Well, they wanted to do their job. They wanted to stay there and bark at a cow. So we left and took that gritty dog with us, and we went and found the next set at three or four, came back. He called those pups off. We took them back to the next set, dropped them off. Literally, this went on for about 2 or 3 hours where we just dropped, and the pups were on each little set of cows for 15, 20 minutes. So the second trip, we came out there second day later, something like that. Those cows were in groups of 8 and 10. I was like, well, this is weird. Same thing. We ride around, never let the cows see us, turn those puppies on them. They didn't want to fight. They just circle and stay wide and loose, never engage those cows. So the cows never wanted to run off. They never wanted to fight. We'd ride around, find the next group, go call the pups off, take them to the next group, do that for a couple hours. The third trip, those cattle were in groups of 15s and 20s. And so on and so on, that by the time we were on our fifth trip, the herd was mostly in one unit. We had a few strays that we had to ride around and find and bump them out. And then we let the cattle see us. And those pups stayed loose, working wide. And we just gently started pushing the herd. But we didn't want to push them too hard because those pups were so loose and they were pups. We didn't want them to get run over by these cattle being still pretty wild, you know, pretty fragile herd that we had put together. But by the sixth trip, those dogs kept everything wadded up. When we got out there, same thing. They were almost all in one group, had a few outliers that we had to kick in, and we drove those cattle to the pen, and they walked into the pens. And I had been after these cattle for a couple of years and could not get a full, clean drive on that place. And that was just using those loose genetics and he said that. He said, you know, those gritty dogs are cool, and everybody likes that. You can sick them on a cow that wants to fight. He said, but I can go all day with these loose-eyed dogs because they won't ever fall in there and fight a cow. Now, you got a cow that wants to run off, that loose dog is typically going to keep giving ground and stay ahead. And if it's a sure enough bunch quitter, that is where a gritty dog that wants to run up there and just hang it on their face can save the day. And so they both have their place. You just have to know when to send which set.
What about different types of cattle? You know, Brahma cattle, Angus cattle, you know, Hereford cattle, whatever. You know, John Coleman Locke is a Brahma breeder down on the Gulf Coast of Texas. Yeah,
you know John Coleman.
Yep. He said any idiot can work a Hereford. So since he said it, I'll repeat it. I wouldn't say it out loud, but
yeah, it is different. The cattle obviously they have to be handled differently, and it definitely affects the dogs too. You know, the funny thing about a Brahman cow is she wants to run with her head in the air like a horse. And so really, even my gritty dogs that want to run around and hit one in the face, they can't. Now,
she's 7 feet tall at the withers.
Yeah. she, uh, she will leave the ground and catch a cow in the face. She will jump through the air and catch one and swing on its nose. But those dang Brahman cows know how to use their front feet. And I've almost lost her a couple of times from leaving the ground like that, hitting the Brahman cow in the face. And the Brahman cow jumps up and grabs them with her front feet and landed on her with her front feet. So the Hereford, Angus, you know, the more English breeds, they tend to travel with their heads a little lower, a little flatter, not quite as erect as the Brahman cow does. So that makes a difference. The baying definitely on the Brahman cattle, it helps, but it makes them nervous, but they will wad up tight when they're nervous. And that is the good thing about them. They look like they're going to suffocate each other. They get so tight, like a set of sheep, I guess. But the Hereford and the Angus don't always necessarily get that tight. They get pretty tight, but they need to be popped a time or two. You don't want to necessarily go popping the Brahman cows because it triggers fight instincts in them pretty fast. And they want to come out hunting the dog. And then the Brahman is funny because she goes ballistic in like just nanoseconds. And then within just a few minutes, when she gets hot, she'll sull up. And I mean, sull up to the point of like laying down and not travel no matter what you do. So it's always a balancing act. John Coleman's right. It takes a special guy handling those Brahman cattle. And the Brahman cross, you know, because then you get into the genetics of like an F1, well, what we call an F1 down here, but the Brahman Hereford cross, that old tiger stripe, she's half Hereford and half Brahman. So half of her wants to stand there and look at you, and the other half of her wants to run off.
Half of her wants to go under the fence. The other half wants to go over it.
Through it. Yeah.
Yep. So I guess, what's your approach when you're taking a set of experienced dogs out to a set of inexperienced cattle?
That's an excellent question, because I used to get that call a lot of guys wanting me to come pen a set of cows they couldn't get, or just, you know, they were nasty. The cows don't respect the dogs. That's the very first key. So a gritty dog can kind of help you, but it can also kind of cause you a fight, because the first pop or two, that cow might yield. But after a while, that dog is basically a bluff. Now, yeah, you might see blood on the nose or even under a dew claw, but ultimately it's a 44-pound dog against a 12 to 1400-pound cow. And it's just a bluff. At some point, you're going to run its course if she won't make up her mind to yield to that dog. So when I'm going to a set of cows that aren't dog broke, I try to treat those dogs as much like a cowboy as I can. In other words, I let those dogs push, which is different than I handle a set that are dog broke, obviously. But again, I told you my dogs have a lot of strong balance in the beginning part of the interview, and that's that they want to work on the opposite side of the herd. So it does take a handle. You have to put some training on them to override that instinct to want to be opposite of me. But it doesn't take that much to talk them into staying on the same side of the cows that I am and just help me push. And then what I usually do, you know, if I'm by myself, I try to find a fence, throw those cows up against a fence, and then I'll put the dogs behind the cows and let them push, which is what they want to do. And then I'll try to ride out in like a flanking position, kind of out to the side, but maybe slightly toward the front, but just enough that I can still talk to the dogs and they're not trying to push and hold everything together, but I'm helping push at the same time and kind of keep the cattle against the fence. Then if something wants to break out, run off, or maybe the leaders get a little too trotty, because mine are head dogs, I just yip them ahead to the front. They go shut the leaders down and bring them back. Maybe I step to the back of the herd and keep pushing and try to keep some forward momentum, that sort of thing. If I'm in like a big pasture that I'm trying to gather by myself or something and I can't get to a fence because I'm still trying to throw the herd together, I kind of set those dogs out in like a skirmish line. You know, we're riding abreast of each other. They're out to my sides, left and right. I don't train my dogs like trial dogs. I don't have a million whistles and a million different commands where I can control if they move their left ear or their right ear. Those dogs are amazing, but I get separated from these dogs. I'm trying to talk to more than one dog at a time. And so basically I want their instinct to kick in to always be pushing cattle to me. And if they're doing that, then they're on the right path, and I'm not going to scold them too much about what they do or what their technique is. But in a skirmish line type of a situation where we're pushing cattle ahead, I still want that herd to come together. So I may send those dogs out wide to have them bring cattle kind of into my direction, but keep them back behind the cattle. Their instinct is still strong to run up in front and get on the other side. And I'll have to call them back and say, stay back here, help me push. you'll get the occasional cow that wants to turn around and maybe fight. And so we have to push. And then I'll usually step in with my horse and push that cow, so the dogs don't have to fight her while they push the rest of the herd. But, that's kind of how I use them in a day working situation on cows that aren't dog broke. The other thing you throw into the equation is working with other cowboys, and you almost have to know the cowboys you're riding with, or else leave the dogs in the trailer, because those guys have got to, they got to respect your dogs and know that the dogs are capable, and that, and they kind of take priority, that, that the cowboys are there for a reason, but let the dogs do their job. You know, don't sit there and stare at it and let the cow run over a dog. I tell people all the time, man, step in there and help him, you know, get that cow off of him so he can go, you know, get the rest of them. But at the same time, some guys will get the hoorah and running back and forth and slapping their leg and run over my dog, you know, because they're not paying attention. That damn dog's in my way, and get grumpy about it and stuff like that. And then in those cases, I keep my dogs pretty tight, close to my horse, if I know a guy's not respecting my dogs. But the other thing is a lot of leg slapping, a lot of hollering and yipping, just, you know, how people think that they need to yell at a cow to make it move. That affects my dogs, because my dogs are, even though they're not trained as well as a trial dog, they're still listening for my voice, and they know my voice. It's not like if somebody else says, come by or wait to me, they just take off. They know my voice. It's more the guttural sounds, because I use a lot of guttural. Tone of voice is huge with these dogs. Tone of voice is probably more important than an actual command. Sure. That is 100%. You can train these dogs by clearing your throat, but if I use a kind of an angry growly sound like a mama dog would on her pups, those dogs are going to flatten out or widen out, give ground. They're going to yield in some way, because they think I'm angry, you know. And then I use, to keep them working and keeping them encouraged, I kind of talk like an idiot. I get all silly and I talk like I'm talking baby talk to them. People look at me like I'm an idiot, but I'm telling you, those dogs will give you your life if they think you're happy. They just really want to make you happy. And so you just have to be careful with who you're working with. If I think the guys that I'm with aren't going to respect the dogs, I won't even unload them. Or if the ranch owner shows up with his prize golden retriever that's running around getting into everything, I just leave my dogs in the trailer. Like, aren't you going to unload your dogs? No, sir. If you put that dog up, I will.
But, yeah. I suppose that commands and those different things are could be overused to the point that they cease to be effective on the dog and the dog will quit. Is that a day by day deal? Can you can ruin a dog with commands and trying to be too hard on them or whatever, you know, kind of break their spirit. Do you see some of that, or how do you think about those things?
Most definitely. One of the guys that I respect a lot when I first started getting into dogs told me this, and it sounds harsh, so you interpret it how you want, but it means what it means. He said, you can take whatever you want out of them with the heel of your boot, but be careful, because you can't ever put it back in. So that means a dog that's really trying to work, you know, but for whatever reason you shorted out that day and you got a little too rough on him, you know, maybe it was vocally, if you had a real timid dog, or maybe he's a really hard-headed, gritty dog and you sure enough stomped on him with your boot, which I've seen guys do. It's not a technique I aspire to use in my situation, but I have seen guys short out on dogs, and you will ruin them. These dogs are intelligent, regardless of what people think. They are very intelligent, and once they've learned their lesson, they don't unlearn it, for good or for bad. So you might have just had a bad day that day, and you shorted out on that sucker, and man, he learned his lesson, and now he won't go back to a cow. And you're like, what in the world? This dog just quit me one day. Well, maybe think back on what happened.
Right.
Or that leads into the sneakiness of where you're saying you're giving a command all the time, but you don't actually do anything to reinforce it. Or you're saying, no, get out of there, stop. Or maybe you do reinforce it. Maybe you take the broom and you whack him. You know, I've had guys who said their wife got after a dog for chasing the barn cat, you know, and whooped the dog with a broom or whatever, and all of a sudden the dog quit working. That's probably more of a timid type of a dog, and, you know, less hard-headed, less strong-willed. Because that is another thing that makes these using dogs, true stock dogs, really good, is that they can get kicked by a 1200 pound Brahman cow, or tried to mash by a bull that ran, but they hit the dirt rolling and they come up with blood in their eyes. They want to fight, you know, they come back for more, and that's, God bless their souls, what makes them so beautiful, but also what can make them so frustrating when you're trying to train them, if you don't understand them. And that's why I said, you know, early in the deal, like, I'm more of a dog observer. What are his strengths? What's he good at? Where can I use him? Where does he fit? And where does he need help? And then I'm going to try to help him where he needs help, and I'm going to let him shine where he shines. So I think I lost track of your question there about, oh yeah, you were talking about, you know, overusing a command. I think the only commands that get overused is that they get ignored. Mm-hmm. It kind of like your kids. If you nag your kid, nag, he knows you're not going to do anything, or he knows you're not, you know, like my mama, she did that whole count to three. I knew I didn't have to move to 2.5. Yep. At three, she was whooping me, but I've seen some parents that get all the way to like 5 and they hadn't done it. They're like, really, what are you going to do? You going to count to 20?
Yeah. Back, kids back, back before I had kids, when I still knew how to raise them, you know how that goes, right?
right.
I heard somebody say, you know, we aren't teaching our kids obedience. We're teaching them fractions. 1, 2, 2.5, 2¾.
That's exactly right. Now they know how long they have exactly before they have to do it. And so it's the same thing with a dog. There comes a point where you may have to put your hands on him. And when I say put your hands on him, I literally mean put your hands on him. I don't mean beat him, hit him. I definitely do not endorse hitting him or using a foreign object, a rolled up newspaper. Even I do everything with my hands. Mm. But again, I know the dog and the breed that I'm running. I'm not saying that a rolled up newspaper didn't work really good on your whatever, you know, your toy poodle.
Right.
But for my dogs, they are so in tune with me and what I want that they know I'm not happy when I go to them. They know they've messed up before I get there. And so like usually just growling at them and showing them my teeth, you know, that old story about Davy Crockett grinning down a bear. I'm pretty sure that's what he was doing. He wasn't grinning. He was showing him his teeth.
Yeah.
And I do that. I grin and show my teeth at those dogs when I'm not happy. And I kind of use that kind of a growl at them. And that's kind of from back of my horse. But on top of that, if they're doing good, I lean over and I call them up to let them jump on my leg or up on my horse. And I rub their head and tell them, I don't train with treats. Those dogs, their treat is that they're getting to work a cow and they love it. Mm. And just a little praise for me goes miles. But if I have given him a command 2 or 3 times and he is blatantly ignoring me and continuing to do what he's doing, I step off that horse and I go to him. And at that point, usually what I do is I grab an ear and I push their head down, but I'm squeezing that ear and kind of twisting it a little bit. And I don't mean in some sort of hearing damaging type. I mean, literally like if I had my mouth on him and I was biting him, but I'm using my hand and push him down and I growl and I get right in his face as I'm doing it. That usually fixes my situations, but that is my like extreme form of discipline on them. Usually tone of voice and then just patience. That's the main tone of voice and patience. If you're using the appropriate tone of voice, you do have to mind your own temper. If you're having a bad day and crap's just not going right, but those dogs are trying their heart out for you and you get growly because the day's not going right, the dogs read that it will affect them negatively. I do have one dog, my main lead dog. This dog, she's got a reputation all over the place. I've got puppies in different states. And she's pretty well renowned. Her name's Chili. And she is my half blood Border Collie Australian Shepherd. That dog, I have to be careful growling at her because, say, there's a hole in the fence kind of on the right hand side, and I sent her way to me to go block and push the cows away from that hole. She is, and the dogs do this, they're left and right handed. She prefers come by, which is clockwise. So she tears out to my left, you know, I said that wrong, but anyway, she tears out to my left, but I intended for her to go around counterclockwise and go around the right-hand side. If I go, Chili, get out of there, come here, something's fixing to bleed because her reaction is not to flatten out and get timid. There's not a timid bone in her except toward me, but something's fixing to bleed or she may even run cattle through a fence so I have to, Chili, come here, that'll do. And I just basically keep calling her back to me and keep saying, wait a minute, send her around that way again. And she goes, come by, Chili, that'll do. And I just kind of break her down because she gets, you know, 100 yards from me and boom, she changes directions at the last minute at the herd. And then I make her come all the way back to me. And then I send her again all the way back to me. You're basically kind of wearing some of that fresh off, just like you would a colt. You know, you just those miles wearing them down. It's not that I got to beat her over that. I just keep sending her, calling her back, send her. Now, obviously, you got to have a recall or that drill doesn't work. So some commands are essential. But eventually, all of a sudden, I see the switch click and she goes the right direction. I'm, yeah, good job. And then she's super happy and she's working twice as hard and she's in the right spot. You know, it patience and persistence and all that pays off big time with those dogs.
Yep. So you were talking about seeing a hole in the fence. Does the dog see that hole? I'm just here confessing my ignorance today. So does the dog see that hole, or how does that work?
I'm going to say 75% of the time, no. However, my border collie, my lead male, his name's Jasper. That sucker is one of the smartest dogs I've ever seen. I swear he can read my mind. There have been so many times a wreck was blowing up and I'm riding hard to get somewhere and I look up and Jasper's already there. So I would say that four of my five dogs would never see that hole, but Jasper might. Mm. Do they recognize it as a hole? I don't think so necessarily. But there have been times where like a gate got left open and I look up and Jasper's laying in it. And he's keeping, like, say, my saddle horses from getting out or something. He's just laying there because he knows that gate's not supposed to be open. The other dogs are not doing that. They're more my little pack of piranhas. They think less and react first. Jasper is definitely a thinking dog, but he's also my least aggressive dog. Now, he bites hard. And when I give the magic command, he's going to draw blood. But he just doesn't have that always kind of on the attack. He's a thinking dog. I hadn't had that dog a week. He was a year old, kind of already started. I got him from a buddy. And that's a whole nother story, but I did not have a bond with this dog is what I'm getting at. I'd had him for a week, maybe two at the most. And gate got left open and I came out of the barn and looked up and all of my brood mares were gone. They were out of this pasture. Well, I live on a county road. My house is real close to it. So they're on the county road, but I live in the middle of this road. I don't know if they went left or went right. And I literally jumped in my truck and came to the end of my driveway and kind of a flip of a coin went, I'm going left. Because I didn't see any tracks. It was getting late. I didn't have time to look for tracks either. But I went left. And no kidding, a mile and a half from my house on this county road, and they were moving. They were at a long trot. Jasper was in front of them. I had no command on that dog. I had no bond with that dog. He hadn't been there long enough to know the routines, but he knew those horses weren't supposed to be out and he was ahead of them. Now, he wasn't getting them stopped and he wasn't getting them turned around, but he wasn't running from them. He was zigzagging back and forth of them, but as he gave ground, but it's hard for a dog to stop horses because, again, they run with their heads up in the air. It's hard to bite and they're prone to stomp a dog and come at a dog, you know, so it's a whole different scenario, but I could not have been more pleased with that dog that he stayed with them. I ended up blowing past him with my truck, got him stopped and turned around. And then I led him back to the pens with my truck and he stayed behind him, kept him moving behind my truck, which is how I handle dog broke cattle. Once I get a set of cattle that I've been taking care of, I lead and the dogs stay behind them, pushing them to me.
So, how many guys can a dog replace?
Oh, you know, there's lots of people that make those claims. That's kind of an arrogant statement, really. You definitely can replace cowboys, but it just depends on how good at cowboys you're talking about. I could replace a whole pack of some guys, but, you know, I've got some buddies that are pretty dang handy, and I'd kind of like to have them even if I had the dogs. So,
sure. I want to jump back quite a ways to a statement you made a couple of different times about putting up dogs and get some idea of what that looks like. When you talk about needing to have a dog locked up, or they're going to go find cows, is that 24/7? Is that when you're not there to keep an eye on them? What's putting up a dog look like?
I'm so glad you brought that up because that is one of my pet peeves, and that's dogs running loose. Now I've had dogs running loose, you know, in my life as well, and we all have that one old loyal dog that kind of keeps an eye on the place. But these sure enough using dogs that want to go get in trouble. They just need to be put up. I have a set of above ground kennels that they live in as far as overnight. Now, these dogs help me every day, all day. That if I'm home working, they're with me. And usually from a pretty young age. Now, before a year old, anything can happen. They can get distracted, sneak off, end up somewhere else. But somewhere around a year of age or so after that, if I'm home and I'm working, they're out of their kennels and they're with me. And they follow me every step I make. Now, again, different breeds may be slightly different. I probably wouldn't recommend that with cur dogs because they are scent dogs. They tend to want to put their nose down and go find something. And they don't have that same desire to stay with you. So those dogs, generally most guys that are running cur dogs, leopard dogs, that sort, they keep them put up except when they're using them. And that is in some sort of a kennel scenario, whether it's in your old stock trailer or kennels that you've built down on the ground, up in the air, whatever your preference is. we live in the sand here, so I get a lot of fleas, and my above ground kennels tend to help with that. Plus, you know, they're not down in the wet and the nasty. They're up on dry boards, and then they've got a barrel with hay that they can get into that barrel inside. So they're under protection. They've got a metal roof over it, so they're out of the sun because it gets pretty hot here in the summertime. And then the cold driving rain, you know, I'm taking care of them. They're outside, yeah, but they've got protection because they can't, if you lock them up in an open top kennel on wet ground, man, they can't do anything. A dog will naturally, just like a coyote or something, will burrow and dig. So they want to do that, and then they end up digging out or something like that. You got to give them something, but you know, up on concrete at least, but with a house or of some sort that they can get into. But my stock trailer serves the purpose a lot of times, especially when I'm out, because most guys, especially the guys I work with, we do a lot of stuff horseback, from sorting dries, separating the bulls out, you know, sorting pairs off, or stripping the calves off the cows before we brand, you know, and run the cows down the chute, that sort of thing. So we do all that stuff horseback. I don't want my dogs in there in the way. And my dogs are pretty mannerly. They know if I don't call them into the pens, they're supposed to stay on the outside. And so I could let them run loose because I know they won't come in. But, you know, that dog wants to be where the work is going on and where I am and where the pressure is. And so just his presence sometimes, even though he's on the outside of the pen, that can cause cows to balk at a gate and not go through. And then you're kind of, things aren't going smooth. They're not flowing. You're like, why is this not working? I know why, you know. And then it also encourages any of my other buddies who may have brought their dogs for the day. If they see me putting mine up, it's kind of like being a leader. Like we've got the cows gathered. They're in the pens. We got them caught. Give me just a second. I'm gonna put my dogs in the trailer and then I'm gonna come back and we'll get started. And not everybody takes the hint. Some guys like to leave their dogs. It's some sort of a matter of pride to let their dog run the whole time. And some of those dogs want to be sneaky and creep into the pen and literally be trying to drag calves, and something keeps busting them, you know, kind of at the backside of the herd, and you look up and there's a dang dog half underneath the pen taking cheap shots at calves, you know, on their ankles, and they're screwing up my shot every time I try to throw my rope. Same thing, you know, now some guys, their dogs are pretty handy. Blue heelers, I've known several that are really handy along the chute. Like you get a set of cows that just don't want to flow through the snake, and that dog kind of understands his deal to run along there and pop those heels and keep those cows moving forward. That's really handy. But that dog has a definite specific job. And my dogs are better. They're more experts at gathering. They have helped me push up the kennel, up the snake. But they are more head dogs. They don't want to reach down there and bite that foot. They are going to raise up and bite the cow in the face, which just causes cows to run backwards in the snake. So my dogs are not effective in those situations. That being said, I have taken care of a set of yearlings at a local sale barn here where the guy didn't want the cattle roped and doctored in the pasture. He wanted me to pin all the sick ones and bring them into the barn, run them through the chute, vaccinate or doctor them that away, and then turn them back out. Well, if you've ever spent any time in a sale barn, you know there's always activity, even if it's not sale day. And the first day I did it, it was like the 2 days after the sale. And I got my six cut out, had them standing in the pen, rode all the way through the barn, set like 158 gates to the snake, turned around to go get my cattle, and every freaking gate behind me was already changed, and I never saw another human. I don't even know how it happened, but it dawned on me. I was like, this is what these dogs are for right here. So literally, I went all the way back through, and I got the dogs, and I had the dogs driving the sick calves to me while I rode in front of them opening gates. And I never shut a gate behind me, like, because that's just how the sale barn operates. Obviously, I didn't leave any gates open out to the highway. I mean, internal gates. Right. But those cattle literally pushed sick cattle for me all over that barn. And if something was going on in an alley, was tied up or busy, where people were sorting, I just did a detour and went down and around. And it didn't matter. Those dogs just kept those cattle shoved right in behind me, to the point that after a few times of doing it, I started noticing every now and then I'd have an audience up on the catwalks watching me. They're like, that's the coolest thing we've ever seen. I'm like, I always joke, these dogs would be a lot more handy if they just had thumbs. I got to open all these dang gates for them.
Yeah. So I got a couple of questions from my private Facebook group that I wanted to run by you. And we've kind of danced around some of these issues, but I'd like to hear your perspective on them specifically. So first one, all of these actually come from former guests of the podcast, but the first one is from Brian Mose. He says, with stock dogs, would you, David, ever use a biting dog? Which I think we've answered that question, but he says, here's his context. Some blue heelers can bite too much and cause too much stress. Even if they make work faster, I don't like how it stresses the cattle. So just kind of your elaboration on that idea, I guess.
Yeah. So with trying to be respectful to that guy's opinion, we all have different opinions on how we work cattle and what we view as stress and what we don't view as stress. Maybe someday there'll be some sort of standardized form that we could check a list, but different breeds react differently. So what stresses a Brahman might not even phase a Hereford. So, you know, a lot of that depends on the breed you're trying to work. Blue heelers do bite a lot, but they generally bite with a purpose. They're not just in there antagonizing cattle. Now, if the cattle are captured like in a snake and they can't move forward and the dog just keeps popping them, well, that's shame on you. Mm. That's absolutely shame on you. That's your fault for not putting a better handle on that dog to say, you know, down, quit, get out of there, back off. Whatever command you want to put on him, that's absolutely your fault. But people don't want to take that ownership. And that's kind of some of the things that I get into when I talk about I'm not a dog trainer, I'm a dog observer. That dog has a lot of bite, then it's your responsibility to back off that bite. If he has zero bite, unfortunately, it's very hard to put bite in them. You can take it away from them, but you can't put it in very well if they're not instinctively having that desire to reach in and bite. So that's kind of where it came up with a lot of the sheepdog people are really hard on cowdog people, saying your dogs bite too much, they bite too hard, that bite isn't necessary, my dog can move all these 200 ewes with just his presence. Well, I would invite those same sheepdog guys to bring their dogs and come with me to South Texas in the brush sometime and see how well that dog can use his presence and do anything.
You know, as
there's
a
reason we have this many different breeds.
Right. And as a guy who's recently gotten into the sheep business and has attempted to sort sheep a few different times, those two critters might process grass the same way, but they are not the same animal. There is nothing else.
They don't process
the
oxygen
same.
The same way.
Right. There is nothing the same about a cow and a sheep in the stockmanship sense. I mean, it's totally different. So,
yeah, most sheepdog guys are pretty hard on a dog that grip. They call it grip. We just call it bite, but that grips too much. Like I said, if he doesn't bite, he can't live on my place because I can't feed a dog that won't bite. I need him to bite. I can back him off if I have to, but you know, that's another thing too. Usually with age, they learn, even my gritty dogs that like to bite and like to work close and fight, they've learned that over time, they don't have to bite a cow every time they need her to move. And they get smart about it. You know, you just kind of have to trust them to develop that and mature, but you've got to have some patience. You can't just label that dog bites too much. Well, that's a snapshot of that moment and what was happening. Was there a lot of chaos? Was there a lot of bawling? Were they in a tub crowded and milling around and a lot of movement? Those are all the things that trigger a stock dog to A, want to work, and to B, want to grip. You know, one that doesn't move much doesn't elicit that same response out of these dogs. Blue heelers definitely have a bad rap, and I'm not a huge fan of them, but I have had them in the past, and they definitely have their place. They're actually very good in a set of pens. For one, they're so freaking tough. I think you could run over one with a Sherman tank, and he'd get up and try to bite the tank. But they just – that tenacity, because in a set of pens, the cow is confined and trapped, and that whole fight-or-flight instinct, they can't flee because they're in a set of pens, so they fight. They go straight to fight most of the time, so – a good tough blue heeler in a set of like sale barn, feed yard, those kind of close quarter deals, where especially because this is where I usually ridicule the blue heeler. I always call it cheap shots. they take those cheap shots from behind, you know, and so but they can duck under a pen and then reach out and grab that cow and kind of, and save their own life. But in that's just a dog being smart. He's saving his own life. You see those videos all the time. People be just bragging on a dog that looks like he's getting killed by a bull in the pen with the bull, but he won't back off. I'm like, yeah, that looks great, but all I see is a giant vet bill. You know, maybe that's not how other people see it, but if I was going to get in the ring with Mike Tyson, I'm going to try to dodge all the punches I can. I'm not going to stand there and take them so everybody call me tough. That's stupid at some point. Again, they're, 45, 50 pound dog at most, and they're fighting 1,200 pound cow, 2,000 pound bull, whatever. That sucker needs to stay alive first and foremost so he can live to fight another day. But I, So yeah, you're going to get that when it comes to biting and guys' opinions. And definitely maybe you don't want a really gritty dog that grabs a hold of a sheep the same you would a dog that needs to bite a 1200 pound cow that's trying to hurt him. You know, the ewes may run at them and they can sure enough mash them. And I'm not even saying a ewe couldn't hurt a dog, but the chances are much less likely than a 1200 pound Brahma cow that's coming after him trying to smoke them down.
Yep.
So presence, just that dog not flinching can have, I think, a presence on the ewe and make her want to turn and move away from that, especially because the whole flock tends to do it. And that is the thing about sheep. They tend to move as a unit. They don't tend to act right too much as individuals.
You talk about tough blue heelers. We had a blue heeler growing up, and she loved to bite cars and bite tires on cars and coming in and out of our driveway. And one time I watched her bite this car tire and get her tooth hooked in the hubcap and do like three rounds with that wheel before her tooth snapped off and she rolled off into the ditch. And, you know, like any other dog would get up and slink away hurt. That dog got up mad and wanted to bite the tire.
I have seen it. Those dogs, like I said, all these breeds have a place. They have a purpose. You just kind of need to know what your situation is and then try to fit the dog best to that situation.
Yep. Well, and I think, you know, I think another thing is like when we're bothered by a situation in a corral, it's probably because we're stressed, and we're stressed because the animal's stressed, and the animals are probably stressed because we're stressed, you know? and so, could you talk a little bit more about that? Like, how do you think about the dogs actually reducing the less level of stress on the cattle as you're working them in different systems?
I tend to tell a lot of stories for my examples, but like a prime example is just when I'm training horses day to day, I've got this set of cattle that honor and respect a horse and my dogs, but because I feed them on foot all the time, they have zero respect for me on foot. They're wadded up around me. I can't hardly shoo them off of me. So when I go trying to push them through just a simple gate that they go through a dozen times or more a day when I'm horseback, they just run around me. They won't stay together. They won't go through a gate. They just try to dodge me. And that is stressful. You know, that probably looks like what a lot of people, when they get their cows to the pens by via whatever means they use, horses, four-wheelers, dirt bikes, whatever. But then they get to the pens and the cattle won't take the gate in the pen that they want. You know, they keep running around them and beating them, and people get frustrated and say things like stupid cow. And meanwhile, the cow's outsmarting them the whole time. But there is just something primal about the presence of a dog and the way a cow reacts to it. Mm. And whether she wants to come fight him or not, it elicits a response that we as humans can't get out of that cow. And I don't know what that is, but I can be frustrated trying to move those cows on foot and literally whistle my dogs in there. And one dog can come in there and in 2 seconds, push the same set of cows through the gate and they don't even argue. Now, obviously the dogs are trained, the cows are somewhat trained. So training you can't just say today I'm going to get a puppy and all my problems. You're going to add problems to your program, not solve them. If you're new, you know, think about buying a good started dog. And when I say started, I mean like a 3-year-old. With the realization that his useful life is about 8 to 9. He may live to be 10 or 12, and he may still be wanting to work at 12. Bless Jasper's heart, he's crowding 12 now and he still wants to work. Mm. And he's super helpful to me, what I do around here, but I don't take him on any wild cow deals anymore. Just, he doesn't deserve that. So, but people think, you know, I'm going to get this 6-8-week-old puppy and then obviously we can all imagine what that ends up looking like. But even a year old pup that's just been started, he's just been started. He doesn't have the confidence. He may have the instinct and he may run on instinct, but the confidence to back a cow down that's fighting, he may get weak and go to barking and yapping and running circles and not stand his ground and bite when he needs to bite and then down when he needs to down and have that just that pure confidence to just stare her in the eye. Mm. And until she backs off. And so the level of stress, obviously we get stressed because it's not going the way we wanted it to. And we get to yell and our voices get high pitched. The dogs read that as well. And that can, if you don't have a good handle on your dog, they perceive your, however they do it, they perceive your stress. Mm-hmm. And it will activate them to sometimes overbite, be overstimulated, that sort of thing. So learning to control yourself in all situations regarding stock helps a lot. But the dog's ability to move those cattle so easily and efficiently can reduce your stress. And because the cattle move, if you're using the dog right, the dog's not going to continue to push once the cattle get where they're supposed to be going. You know, you're going to call that dog out. And that is, maybe there was stress for a momentary period as the dog had to do what he had to do to get the cattle through the gate you couldn't get them through. But once that's over, remove the dog, call the dog to you, keep him with you. Now the cattle can relax and their stress level goes down. But as they learn how to move through your pens, you know, maybe you have four or five gates that have to be maneuvered through before they get through the snake and the squeeze chute and that sort of thing. As they learn the pattern, the cattle will learn and they'll just start to flow. You know, you're probably going to always have those one or two head that need convincing. And that's where the dog can help that. So, but if you don't have a handle and you don't have a way to call a dog out that has a really strong drive to go work, yeah, you're going to make the stress on the livestock worse. And that's where, when I started out at the beginning of this interview, that guy before me, that guy came before you, that sucker couldn't control his dog and they were biting everything and running everything. Well, that guy just ruined it for me. I can't, now he won't let me unload my dogs and show him what it's supposed to look like. Right. So people's perception is huge on that, and having a good handle on your dog. I'll say this too, you know, my dogs, because they're such strong head dogs and they have that balance where they want to work on the opposite side of you. If you take one of my puppies, and I tell people, I preach this, if you take one of my puppies and you don't put that handle on him and have the ability to call him back to you, when you are pushing a set of cows to the pens, my bloodlines will be the dog that runs up there and gets in that gate and stands in the gate. And I know we've all seen that dog, and we can all imagine the kind of ugly names he was called and the person that owned him, and maybe it cussed his bloodline and everything else. But that's that dog's instinct. And what I tell people a lot of times is, like, even if you don't have a handle on him, try this, try trading places with him. And people will look at me with the most astonished look, like I'm speaking Greek. They don't have a clue what I even am saying. I'm like, well, you have to trust the dog for one. And if he's a puppy, I can't trust him. Well, you're right. You probably should be practicing this at home before you go try to pen all your cows. But because he has that desire to work opposite of you, by you switching places with him and you go get in the gate, you're going to give ground. You're going to move away. Those cows are going to have someplace to go, and he's going to want to come to you and push those cows. Does that mean three or four might not sneak off while he's pushing on all of them? It doesn't. But the cows get trained as you do it. You trust him. Maybe get most of the cattle penned. Then you got to go, you know, capture the renegades, or maybe he leaves with the runaways, but maybe the rest of the herd's kind of quiet and they continue to stand there while he chews on the renegades and brings them back and that kind of thing. A lot of it has to do with being able to just trust the dog and that his instincts are right. I had a buddy that he was never a dog guy, but after several years of watching mine, he was like, all right, I'm in, I got to get one. Well, he, very, very good top hand, really good cowboy, but he was not take my advice. And I wasn't going to get in his face. It's his dog. He'd do what he wanted. But I don't know how many times we'd be doctoring yearlings and he would leave that dog running loose. And we're trying to rope, and this dog is running up, hitting it in the face, making it dodge. By the time you throw it, you'd miss every time. And he's screaming and hollering at this dog, I'm going to kill you, God dang, and all this kind of stuff. I'm like, you just have to put that dog up in those situations. This is not a time to have that dog running loose. You can take him with you when you're prowling, looking for sick cattle, but go put him up when you actually go to do that.
Yeah.
Anyway, I think I might have got off track a little bit.
No, it's good. It's good. I could listen to you talk dogs all day. But I guess one last question, and then I want to give you a chance to share about some of what you've got going on. Then we're going to transition to I got to get something off my chest about bits and horses and stockmanship, but that's going to be in a bonus episode. So anyways, I got one last question from the private Facebook group. Says, is a dog ever too old to train?
I think that is possibly true. I think, could you put some basic commands to where he could be functional? Yes. I don't think any dog is ever too old to go through some sort of obedience training. My kids are big in our 4-H program, and they use these same dogs that I'm working cows with, and they take them to town and they do agility. That's all those tunnels and jumps and teeter totters and all that stuff. They do obedience, they do rally. And, I think anytime you're teaching a dog, you're teaching a dog how to learn. And I think that's a good thing. So establishing that environment right off the bat helps. So if you have an older dog, just starting with something as simple as sit or lay down is going to build to the next thing that you could teach a recall. And then the, you know, there's different methods and strategies on how you teach. And I won't go into that because methods are all different. There's a million different methods. It's the principles that are all the same, you know? So, but usually what's going to happen with an older dog is it's going to be a dog that was a rescue for some reason. Maybe he was chasing cars or whatever. He was cute and fuzzy at one time, and then he bit the mailman, and like, you know, whatever. Or he's been yelled no at a lot for chasing the barn cat, chasing cars, and they, you know, they kind of shut him down, or he just made him sneaky, so they got rid of him. So when you start with an older dog, you got to know what is the background. If it's your older dog and you just never let him work, well, okay, let's think realistically back through, what did you do? Did you yell at him no all the time? Can you, is he still trying to be sneaky? I think a sneaky dog you could probably work with, but he's going to always be sneaky. Mm. The most important part is just being able to capture him. And I do that by making him drag a long line, about 25 foot of cord, you know, a lightweight, so that it's got a little weight and you can catch them, but it's not so heavy that they can't move dragging it, obviously. But that long line's where they're working at a distance from you and you're not actually touching them, but you can reel them back in if you need to. That works magic on a dog. Sometimes a dog that's been shut down and won't go to stock anymore because he's been told no. If you can go to him to a reputable trainer, I've done this with dogs where I'll set them in my round pen with four or five yearlings that are somewhat dog broke, but they're not going to come after a dog. And I'll take that dog with me in the middle and I'll literally just, just try to scatter those cattle. That you'd be surprised how cattle scattering and going in different directions, that chaos is what, and again, it depends on the breed, obviously, but like my border collie dogs cannot stand chaos. They cannot stand cattle going in different directions. They want to wad them back up. The cur dogs are the same way. Heelers tend to just want to push all the time, but you know, so they may lock onto one and drive it versus, you know, having that turn on a blue heeler as much. But blue heelers aren't, again, exceptions to everything. They're not generally known as herding dogs as far as wanting to keep them wadded. They want to push on them and push away from you generally. But the chaos can trigger something in a dog that maybe has been shut down and make him come alive. And he may not be doing it right, but you just need him to start wanting to do something. And then try to cultivate that. And that's all you can do is cultivate what you see in them. And if he's never going to be a really tough, strong, gritty dog, you need to be okay with that or get a different dog or maybe just get an additional dog. Sometimes those dogs aren't really gritty, but they have a really good handle. Like they're very compliant with a recall, whatever your recall. I say that'll do when I'm done and I need them to, I say that'll do. And how you say the word, very important. Mm. My kids used to want to say that will do, that will, like, no, it's very important. They hear our enunciation and it's that'll do, like rattle, paddle, battle,
right.
That'll do. But you may say here or come here or come or whatever. You just want to think about your commands because come or come here can sound like come by. Mm. So maybe you don't say come here if you say come by, or maybe you say by instead of come by. A lot of people tend to use the word get. I think somehow get has the magic. Get in, get out, get over here, get in the truck, get in the trailer, get in your – stop saying get. Get is not the universal command. Think about what you're saying to to dogs. You know, they're smart, but when they hear get, they're just on to the first thing they're thinking about. So,
good stuff.
Taking an old dog is definitely tricky. Not saying it's impossible, but it's definitely a little more difficult if he was never exposed to it.
Okay, so we've opened up the possibility of somebody wanting to jump in and start using dogs on their place. Show notes page for today, workingcows.net/169. Are there any resources I could put there that would be helpful in helping them learn how to get started with dogs, or is the best resource their neighbor that's good with dogs?
you know how neighbors are. Be careful of your neighbor. They always know a lot, think they know a lot more than they do, I think. But if there is a reputable guy in your area that everybody kind of recommends, yeah, it's worth a phone call or driving by his house and visiting with him and picking his brain and seeing what he recommends. You know, some guys are just trying to sell dogs, and then some guys are sure enough trainers. And so you want to be leery of if he's just trying to sell you a dog or is he truly trying to help you fit your situation. As far as two resources, the two that I know of that I use and I highly recommend them, the problem is they're out of print. Mm. So if you scour the internet, you probably find them. There are probably some really good sheepdog trainers, probably more prolific than a true, sure enough, cow dog guy, especially when it comes to like border collies and kelpies. But And then the other is L.R. Alexander. And both of those guys have little thin paperback books, and I don't have either one of their books handy. I've loaned them out to a buddy, and I guess he thinks they're his now. So anyway,
I'll try to track them down.
But yeah, I would imagine if you scour the internet for L.R. Alexander and Ben Means, you might find something. I think there's websites like Ben Means. I think he had a website, and his wife may still run it. Charlie Trayer has Hanging Tree Cow Dogs, and he has a really good website. And I think he does like maybe a blog or a newsletter or something like that. His stuff is really good and really right on. And then that's it. I've got one sheepdog book that I have flipped through, and I've found a little nugget or something that I can use here and there. But if you're looking for somebody to kind of show you, tell you how, you kind of have to know what you're looking for already. And that sheepdog book was more because I kind of already had a handle on what I needed. And I kind of discovered the information. It was not helpful to my situation per se. It was more helpful because of the way I was able to apply it. But there is another guy named Lynn Dalton, and Lynn is deceased as well now. And Lynn's an old crossbreeder as well. He was crossing blackmouth yellow curs and American bulldog with border collies. And those genetics are out there. You'll hear people talking about Lynn's dogs or a Dalton dog. He was in Louisiana, and but had dogs in West Texas and all kinds of places on big ranches, handling a lot of cattle. But what he did with those, the cur, the blackmouth yellow cur and the American bulldogs, he was able to take a lot of that hair off that border collie and make a more heat resistant dog, which obviously is a problem for us down here. The border collies, as much as I love them, bless their heart, they can get smoked down. They can get smoked down in the wintertime. I've literally been gathering yearlings and it was below freezing, and my dogs will jump in a water tank and sit there for 2 or 3 minutes trying to recover, just because it's just different down here, you know, and dogs don't sweat. Those are definitely things to remind people that don't know or never paid attention. A dog cannot sweat. And so if he's getting hot, you need to know what the signs are. Even in up as far north as you are, I'm sure they can overheat. And know what the signs of a dog that's overheating look like. They definitely happen in stages. Very recognizable once you know what they are. And be okay with letting that dog take a break. Now, there is a difference between letting him taking a break, sending him to water, and a dog that wants to go hide in the water trough. that's a training topic. Yeah, but yeah. Dogs will find security and safety by hiding in a water trough and to avoid a tough situation. And that can kind of become a problem.
Very good. David, I really appreciate your time today. Anything else you want me to throw up in the show notes page, workingcows.net/169? What do you have going on? And we can edit this out, but are you still doing the Everyday Horseman community and some of that stuff that you were doing last time we talked?
Yeah, I'm still doing that. You know, when the whole Rona hit, I think like a lot of people, I kind of withdrew. I was worried at first. And now my pendulum has swung the other way and I'm irritated. But, at first I was afraid to be marketing and publishing. So I have definitely kind of slowed down on what I was doing because I was afraid to ask people money, knowing everybody was losing their jobs.
Sure.
I think I'm seeing that now that that's not quite so much the case. And, people are definitely still losing their jobs, but, it's different. And so anyway, it's still out there, but I have definitely not been as active. I am kind of in the process right now of trying to gear back up and start running some Facebook ads and that sort of thing to get, just to remind people I'm still here and kind of take it and go from there. But, there's still, you know, a lot of information on there. You know, we've got somewhere around 75 training videos there. They're still up and accessible to the membership. There's stuff on my Facebook page, the A Texas Cowboy and Through the Eyes of a Cowboy, all that is that you can scroll through some of the posts and some of the freebie stuff that we've given away, you know, to encourage people to sign up for the email list so that we can stay in front of you with emails. But the important thing about those videos is you watch them once and you think, okay, well, I've already seen that video, but I don't know if like – Oh, you know, you can just use Lonesome Dove as a, how many times have you watched Lonesome Dove in your life? You didn't just watch it once and go, I've seen that movie. You know, a good one, we keep rewatching it. And I always pick up on something different every time I watch it, but I have a stack of old horse training books and stuff, and they're well-worn. The spines are broken and I've got highlighted, underlined, dog-eared, because those really good resources, you got to keep going back to them because you might have missed it the first time, or maybe it didn't apply to your situation and you didn't realize it. And then Absolutely. You read it the 15th time, you're like, oh my God, that's what that meant. I get it now. And so that's the beauty of the videos, is being able to go back and have that library there to reaccess it. So even if you think you might have seen all 75 videos already, it's worth watching them 2 or 3, 15 more times.
Yep. Very good. Well, the show notes page for today, workingcows.net/169. David, thanks for your time today. And thanks for agreeing to do some bonus episode material on horses and bits.
You bet, man. I enjoyed it. I hope I didn't wear anybody out talking about dogs.
Well, really appreciate David and his time again. And as I said, be sure to check out the show notes page for today, workingcows.net/169, and we will have links to David's work there and other relevant links as well. And looking forward to next week. I think we're going to talk to Curtis about what he's got going on in Montana and some of the things he's been learning running on some lease land and how he's getting started. So look forward to seeing you again real soon with another episode of the Working Cows Podcast.
We invite you to visit workingcows.net to subscribe to the show via iTunes or Stitcher. You'll also find detailed show notes pages, resources from our guests, and the industry leaders who have influenced them. For more ideas on putting your cows to work for you in a more profitable way, tune in next week.